Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello again, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes and, like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, I'm happy to say we're going to start the show this week right out of the gate with one of the usual suspects here at Film Sociology. I generally am still trying to figure out the new, as far as the numerical system when it comes to television seasons and podcasting seasons, because in the old days, it'd be fall to spring with 22 to 30 episodes, but apparently it's happening every quarter, which means I get to talk to this man more than once a year. Simon Majumdar of Eat My Globe podcast and Food Network fame and just all things cool. How are you, sir?
I am very well, very well. It's good to speak to you again. It seems like it's been far too long.
Well, I'm glad. If somebody would really sponsor us, we could make this a weekly, but that's another story for another time. So congratulations on season 8. So far we've had Odd Beasts and Birds, which is actual animals, not slang. Your fun chat with Jacques Pepin and the history of rum. Can you give us just a little bit of maybe a nugget from each of the episodes for those who haven't heard it?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously it's my food history podcast. Odd Beasts and Birds was actually something that was kind of inspired by an email from someone who supports me on Patreon, and they were like, perhaps we could talk about some of the things that have either fallen out of favor or have become extinct. And so I talk about two things. One, I talk about silphium, which is a Roman ingredient, a little like fennel, that was just absolutely something the Romans were addicted to both culinarily and from a medicinal point of view. It was actually used as a form of birth control. And so they used it to an extent that it just no longer exists. And actually went extinct during the Roman period. So that's an interesting one. The interview with Jacques Pepin, you know, one shouldn't have favorites. It's like favorite children. Sophie's Choice. But to have Jacques Pepin do an interview with you, I think is very special. And we spent an hour plus just chatting about all kinds of fascinating things, you know, because this is a man who has literally lived through 20th century culinary history and has shared that with so many people, and so many people, you know, consider him a mentor, and I know so many of the chefs that I know consider him a mentor. So that was just to have time with him like that and talking one-to-one was incredible. And then, of course, you know, I always like to add in a few drink histories when I do them. So rum was a fascinating one, and I tell people, I don't want to ruin any of the surprises, as I call them, but there were some really great stories about where certain words like proof, groggy, and all of those things come from. So all of which are related to rum history. And then coming up next week, we do each episode on Monday, we have David Wondrich, who is the greatest, not just cocktail historian, or one of the greatest that I know. And he's written this amazing book called the Oxford Encyclopedia to Cocktails and Spirits. This thing, you could build houses out of it, so thick. And it's incredible. So we've got lots more really fun episodes to come. And then I have to start thinking about writing season 9, which is tough because, I have to find each season is basically like writing a book. You know, it's over 100,000 words. And so for me to put by, weeks of time to do that, and then for everyone else to put by weeks of time, makes it a little tough. So we do sometimes get criticism from people that it takes us a while to get seasons out, but I hope they understand when they see the kind of the effort that we put into each episode.
Correct. And I mean, we're an anxious bunch, so there is that. well, going back to the Jacques Pepin one, I know you didn't in this, I guess, but especially in all the years you've interviewed people, I know you had a publishing history before this, but have you ever just fanboyed over somebody?
Oh, gosh, yes, all the time. I mean, Jacques Pepin is definitely one, but he makes you feel very comfortable.
Okay.
Another person who I absolutely did, and in fact, pre-pandemic, in the before times, I actually flew across the country to make sure that I could meet with him, and that was Ken Burns.
Mm.
Ken Burns, to me, is, you know, the greatest documentary maker of our generation, and he agreed to be interviewed by me, and even though I just wanted to interview Ken Burns. I didn't even think there'd be anything about food. I just wanted to sit in the same room as Ken Burns. But it turns out, of course, that if you listen to that episode, Ken Burns owns a restaurant in Walpole, New Hampshire. And it is, because it's Ken Burns and he runs it with a colleague there, it's fantastic because, you know, he works from a position of excellence. And you go in and you have food there and it's incredibly well done. Lovely service, nice people. And then afterwards, the next day, we met him in the restaurant and we sat with him for an hour and a half while he talked about, you know, his joys of roast chicken. And I actually wrote him a note to say thank you afterwards.
Hmm.
And I got a note back from him and it was an IOU going, yeah, my name is Ken Burns and I owe Simon McGovern one roast chicken. And it is one of my kind of prized possessions. So mm-hmm. absolutely, if there are certain people in this world who I absolutely do have this kind of fanboy thing from, and he was definitely one.
Well, it didn't show listening to it, as I think I mentioned. I always say Jacques Pepin, like Samuel L. Jackson in Pulp Fiction, has a wallet that says bad MF on it. I hold him that in that high a regard. I think like I said, listening to the interview, it doesn't show, and I've been guilty of it as well, and I think it's the casual aspect of the conversation, but I think it's the fear of turning into, I don't know if you know the SNL sketch, the Chris Farley show.
I do not.
There's a couple, if you go online, it's Chris Farley as an exaggerated version of himself, and he interviews Paul McCartney, and another he interviews Martin Scorsese. And it's, you know, it's the whole everything is awesome and you're just freaking out and it's, you know, not the most professional and you're kind of hitting your, you know, and the guest is taking all of the ridiculous questions in stride. So anyway, it's not that. It doesn't sound like that. But that what comes to mind when hearing a great conversation that you had with Jacques.
Well, I'm glad to hear it wasn't like that. And I'm glad he felt very comfortable and he added in lots of, you know, I think he was really pleased to talk about, you know, although I did mention, you know, Julia Child and I did mention all of those amazing things, I think he really enjoyed talking about some of his history, the fact that he was in the French Navy,
mm-hmm.
the fact that he cooked for, you know, Charles de Gaulle and Madame de Gaulle, cooked for some of the great, you know, prime ministers and, you know, presidents from around the world back in the day. And I think he was just, you know, and also, of course, we're talking about a man who went, you know, left his restaurant or the restaurant he worked at, Le Pavillon, which is one of the great early French restaurants of the United States, and was offered a job to go and cook for the Kennedys at the White House and turned it down because he would rather go and learn some modern techniques at Howard Johnson, which I just think is one of the great stories in food. And where, you know, he was working in this incredibly modern kitchen. And I think people don't realize sometimes just how important places like Howard Johnson's were to getting really good food in front of people and their supply techniques and things that are, you know, a lot of fast food or rather, yeah, regular volume restaurants still use now. So very interesting guy.
Well, as somebody who grew up going to Howard Johnson's in my beloved hometown of Flint, Michigan, I was much appreciative of that. In fact, I had no clue. I had no clue he had that background on that. But yeah, that was growing up in Michigan. They were my introduction to fried clams. And,
absolutely.
And, you know, they're kind of a guilty pleasure because they're not from the city. You know, they're not, you know, it's one thing to get clams on the coast, But, you know, it's breaded and chewy, and that's all I remember of it. And some, and in some cases, and especially in certain pubs, certain bars, that'll do.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why they served them. They got them from a really good place. They were basically the biggest supplier of clams in the United States, and they're really delicious. And I've replicated them as much as I can for meals. Even quite recently, I did when I was doing an event down in Texas. And it is one of these kind of dishes that, particularly if you've got an older audience, they just gravitate towards and they immediately start eating these clams because it just reminds them, very Proustian,
yep.
kind of reminds them of their time, you know, eating madeleines, or in this case, eating clams.
The other thing that Howard Johnson is known for, at least for my memory, was before, and I don't know what kind of ice cream shops you had in England, but before we had Baskin-Robbins, because they pushed 31 flavors, these were the most flavors I'd ever seen in a restaurant. And you think, as a child, you know, you've hit the jackpot. What flavor are you going to get tonight?
Well, I loved all that with the variety of ice creams. You know, if we were in England back in the kind of 70s, it was kind of chocolate, vanilla, strawberry, and maybe if you were very lucky, you might get a banana flavored one.
Ooh, yeah.
Yes, but then I remember coming to New York in the, early 80s or whatever, and staying with my parents' relatives up on the Upper West Side, and they were near a place called, I think it was called the Vermont Creamery, that had 51 flavors, and I was with them for a week, and I made it my determination to eat every single one of them before I left, which I did. I was very proud of them.
Oh, wow. What stood out?
Well, I think it was the first time I'd ever had Rocky Road, which I rather liked.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very American, you know, flavor, and I'd never had no idea what it was. And then I tried it, of course, and it's not something I eat terribly much now. Although I think my wife is a big fan of the thrifty version.
In our household, especially if my daughter's visiting from college, we all have our own stash now. It's just a matter.
Oh, yeah.
That's yours. There's mine. We don't acknowledge each other's snack space stash and just kind of leave it at that. So I think we're all the better for it.
It's like colleagues as well. When the times when people were foolish enough to let me work in an office with other people rather than on my own in a room where I'm not causing any chaos, that you always had your own snack space. And I have to say, there were occasions where there were people who would try and kind of steal my snacks and you know, it's all the things that happen. So yes, it's all very interesting. Snackage, there are some folks, and I'm not going to name who they are, but there are some folks who, when I share, yeah, we swap trailers. If they're in one day in a show and I'm in the next, I know that they're the ones who have stolen all the chocolate almonds and all the I will hold it over them forever. So it still goes on. Trust me, it still goes on.
Have I seen this person on television in the last week?
You've probably seen this person on television many times.
All right, I'll stop.
I'm not going to give anything away.
No, I won't dig. That's okay.
But you know, the craft services on TV have a deep bench, so there's always plenty to eat.
Okay, that's the next endorsement deal. I think that's pretty good. Going back to the rum episode, can you give us a particularly favorite rum cocktail of yours?
Oh my gosh! Well, to me, the honest answer is that I am not a great rum cocktail drinker.
Okay.
Although obviously the original what was known as excuse me, the Hemingway daiquiri, which was not a frozen blended drink, but was a daiquiri that Hemingway created because he didn't want to have sugar. And so it was using grapefruit syrup and something else. I can't remember. Is one of my favorites. But my real thing is, as it is with a lot of sort of dark spirits, is to enjoy them on their own. So for me, you know, a glass of Zacapa rum with a tiny, tiny splash of water in it, tiny,
mm-hmm.
Just to allow the phenolics to come out. The Zacapa 23, which is an amazing one, or I've got a few here that we bought actually when we were traveling recently, and we bought a load of these back from us from the airport, and they actually had as a capa storda, and they are really, really, I mean, just delicious rums. And it's the same, you know, when I'm having a brandy or whether I'm having a scotch, I tend not to mix them in things. I tend to just have them on their own. But there are exceptions. You know, I do love I'm a big fan of the Rob Roy, which is basically a Manhattan made with scotch and traditionally made with Dewars. I think it was invented at the Waldorf Astoria in New York, and someone who preferred scotch, and they made this thing, and they called it the Rob Roy. And to me, you know, with a couple of cherries, that's usually if I'm stupid enough to have two cocktails, which I've stopped doing a lot now because I think I'm getting too old for it now. But if I am, then my first one is always a gin martini with Plymouth gin or Beefeater 24 or Ford's gin or something like that, followed by, and then with a twist, of course, and then followed by a Rob Roy.
That's not bad. That's not a bad way to wind down an evening.
No, it's a great way. It's a great way to wind down or wind up an evening.
There you go. You mentioned New York. Now we're going to transition into the film chat portion of film sociology here. Do you remember the first film you got to see in a New York theater?
So I think, you know, the first few films I saw in New York, apart from maybe if I was taken by relatives and I probably haven't remembered them, I used to go every time I came over to work as a publisher. My last day, when I'd had to check out of the hotel at midday, and then I had a couple of hours or 3 hours before I had to go to the airport, I would always go to one of the theaters on the Upper West Side where I would usually stay and go and see films. And I loved the theaters there because, you know, they were a lot more glamorous than they were in the UK at that time, late 80s, early 90s, and I would go and see all kinds of fun films. But it was whatever was on, and it wasn't anything that I was going to go and see just because, you know, it was special and I was in New York. So I'd go and see silly films like The Mummy or just something that would keep me kind of laughing when I was just trying to spend some time and trying to keep cool in, you know, New York in June or whatever.
Sure.
So I enjoyed that a lot. And the other things that I used to do is opposite the Lincoln Center, I think it was, there was one of these old, still there, I think, art house cinemas. And I used to go in and see, you know, some of the films that they would show there in their kind of screening rooms they would have. And they'd show things like, you know, crazy stuff like Last Tango in Paris or something really, you know, kind of odd that they were just showing because it happened to be there. And I used to go and see some of those as well. So I always enjoyed going to theaters and films in New York. But I will say that most of it was just trying to keep cool rather than any aesthetic of being in Manhattan.
That's understandable. That's a lot of people. I mean, that's still happening today, especially, you know, if you have no air conditioning or it's just hot as blazes and, you know, you're guaranteed comfort for a couple of hours.
Absolutely. Sit there with the thing that I always remember, and of course, I'm sure people have come to this all the time, the ludicrous size of both the drinks and the popcorn and the compared to Europe.
Yes.
Was, and even now I'm still, you know, they actually, I think someone posted it up on Twitter that the kind of smallest size of a drink in the US is double the size of like the largest size of a drink in the UK. And so first of all, as a man of a certain age, you know, when I was in my 20s and 30s, that was not so much of an issue. I could sit through, you know, even an Avengers movie of 8 hours or whatever they are. But nowadays, there's unless I bring in something to hide at the back with, I'm having to leave the theater about three times. So there's lots of times where I end up watching the Disney Channel here at home. Just so I can find out what happened in those 2 5-minute breaks that I've had in the movie when I've been watching a Marvel film or something. And I go, oh, yeah, so now that all makes sense.
Yep.
You know, particularly if it involves portals and people coming back from, you know, different areas. I have to say it's one of the joys, shall we say, in commas, of getting old.
Well, and when you have a drink big enough that you could film Juggernaut in it, that's a problem. So,
and then the sound of of locals crackling away on popcorn is something. So, I will say that we decided to make a choice here at home during the pandemic, where we have bought a TV screen that is basically about the size of a wall. And we decided, there were sales on, and we've got this enormous TV screen, and we're watching a lot of films at home now, and because, it, quite frankly, it's as good as some of the views I'm going to get at the cinema. This thing is enormous and amazing, and we have incredible sound, and when we're watching even some of the TV series that you're getting, which are very cinematic now, whether it's on Apple or whether it's on wherever you're looking at some of these. Foundation is one that's on Apple that I just go, it's that's as good as anything I've seen being spent on anything at the cinema. So I think when you're getting those and you've got a big screen at home, we're still being careful when we go out.
Well, it sounds like your wall is just now big enough that it could support a David Lean film to that size and scope. I feel bad for my TV. My TV's not big enough, and I have even watching enjoying Lawrence of Arabia. I wish I had a wall size TV.
Well, oddly enough, I did watch Lawrence of Arabia not so terribly long ago. It was on Amazon, and I'm not sure how good a print it was, but it was. I watched it, and of course, Omar Sharif riding in from wherever slowly along is Lean is one of my favorite directors, and just had an eye for detail, and that scene as he kind of wobbles around. And then there is that thing that I always say to people, this is not even a kind of a sexual thing. It's like there are certain people in life who you just go, they are beautiful, and it doesn't matter. And Peter O'Toole in Lawrence of Arabia, it's like if you see a young Elvis, or I always say if you see a young Muhammad Ali, it's got nothing to do with like looking at Michelangelo's David. It's got nothing to do with anything else other than you go, all the good looks that God kept from me and lots of other people, he basically kissed those guys with. And Peter O'Toole, when you see him in Lawrence of Arabia, is just one of the most magnificent cinematic spectacles, I think, in history.
Yep. And, of course, that spawned the famous quote from Noel Coward, he's so beautiful, it should be Florence of Arabia.
I was lucky enough to see Peter O'Toole in many a play in London. One of the best was I saw him in Pygmalion, and he was, obviously, which then went into one of my which then turned into one of my favorite musicals, My Fair Lady.
Yep.
With Rex Harrison, who I also saw in perform it in London, but Peter O'Toole just had this kind of flippancy to kind of rich flippancy that he gave to that performance.
Yep.
And when you saw him on stage, there was something just about him that it's hard. You realize why he became such an extraordinary kind of stage and film performer. And I will say, if people haven't watched the film and they really want to go and just see him at his kind of fun best, My Favorite Year is one of my favorite films to watch at any time, and he is he's basically being Peter O'Toole. and he's obviously having a great deal of fun.
Yep.
And if anyone hasn't seen that, I think that's one. You can find it on any of the streaming platforms, I'm sure, but if you haven't seen it, it's not to be missed.
Alan Swan from the movies? Yes, Alan Swan from the movie. I had a physical copy of that. I saw it in the theater when it came out when I was 13. The other thing I always remember is, do you remember his film Venus?
Of course.
With pre-Dr. Jodie Whittaker. I always remember there's only two people in the world that could pull off playing an 80-something gentleman having a serious relationship with a 20-something, and I think it's him and it's Cary Grant, and that's about it.
Cary Grant was a very interesting character because a lot of people don't know that he came over sharing a boat with Charlie Chaplin and Stan Laurel. He was in A Night at the English Music Hall. He was a comedy juggler, Archibald Leach.
That's right.
He came over from England, you can imagine that you've got in a room or certainly in a group of performers from England, that they were all, that you had three of the greatest legends in movie history in one kind of travel over from England.
It's not a bad show.
Go and read about it's called Fred Karno's Night in an English Musical. Mm-hmm. And they all came over, and he was Archibald Leach, the comedy juggler, and he hated his past character so much that he actually named his dog Archibald Leach so he could just shout at him.
Shifting gears a little bit, I talked about this on my show last week, and I wanted to bring it up to you. There is, when you were a young lad, were you ever turned away from a movie because of its content, because you weren't old enough?
Well, I mean, there was one, it was actually very different because, rather than because I wasn't old enough, because I was quite, even at the age of like 12 or 13, I was quite, or beginning to get quite hirsute. So I actually got away with stuff, and I'd put on a jacket that would belong to my dad or something and walk in. And so I got to see, I'm not going to lie, so we had a different rating. We had X rating, which was X rating here. And it wasn't, we're not talking about anything kind of scurrilous, but it was usually horror films. Or,
right.
Or whatever some of the films might have been. I'm trying to think whether it's like The Omen or, The Exorcist or stuff like that. But the one time that I did get turned away was not Tommy. It was another musical kind of film. It might have been Dark Side of the Moon. It might have been one of these films. And the woman at the thing turned me away because she said to me, and she had a very Yorkshire voice, she said, "Oh, you don't want to go and see that, honey." She goes, "It's so boring, you'll fall asleep." So I was actually turned away from the cinema with some friends. She said, "Trust me." She goes, "It's so dreadful. You don't want to watch it, and you don't want to give us your 50 pence or whatever it was to get into the thing in 1978." And I'm trying to think which one it was. It was one of those, something like The Song Remains the Same, or one of those
concert films.
Concert films, and she just goes, "Oh, you don't want to watch it." Trust me. And I was like, "Oh, okay then." So we went off around the corner and had a hamburger and chips, and then we went home. That was the only time that I can actually remember it. It was a classic cinema. I mean, in the days when my little town in Rotherham in South Yorkshire had like three cinemas, and now it doesn't have any, of course.
Right.
But. But at those times, it had these old cinemas that had been around since the 1910s or whenever cinemas started to be kind of, and they were all beautiful inside. I still remember the cinema, absolutely gorgeous. From the 1910s, of course, cinemas were seen as quite a kind of posh, and they wouldn't allow them at the time to sell popcorn inside until later when they realized they could make money out of it.
That's right.
So it was. I still remember going to these cinemas, and they all had great names: the Scala, Gaumont, my favourite one. They were really nice, and they still exist. Was a cinema chain in London called the Odeon.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And it was. It took its name, although it spells a Greek name. It took its name from its owner. He was looking for a name for this cinema and what to call it. And one of his employees came up with this, anagram thing. It was Oscar Deutsch. That was the name of the owner. Ah. Oscar Deutsch Entertains Our Nation. That's where it comes from.
Nice.
And I still used to love going to the Odeon cinema, and you'd pay, I'd pay to sit up in the grounds. You used to pay different prices in those days. You had balconies and that kind of stuff that you don't get so much now. It was just, I have to say, I miss that side of things, because I used to love the ladies, a bit like John Cleese in Hollywood Bowl, wandering down with their tray of ice cream with an albatross. And I kind of always liked that. Your mum, or if you're with your parents, they give you
what wine goes with albatross, since it is bloody seabird flavor.
Absolutely. Something a little snappy.
Okay. The last time we talked, there was a film I forgot to ask you about, because you had talked about it, and then I wound up watching it, so thank you for that. He is an influencer here, friends. But you had mentioned a while back the Frank Sinatra detective story, The Detective.
Yes.
What brought you to watch that? Because that, for me, is like the last time I think Sinatra really gave an effort in front of a camera cinematically.
Well, he was desperate for that role. And I've listened to, there's a terrific podcast called You Must Remember This.
Yep, indeed.
Which is very, very good indeed. And I've just been listening to the one on talking about Porky's and
the erotic 80s.
Yeah, which is really interesting. They talk about, you know, Phoebe Cates, who is someone, you know, when I was 17, I was about the same age as her. And, you know, she was just this extraordinarily beautiful young woman who, you know, when I was probably a year younger than her. But all of those things that we all remember last time. Anyway, but they did a series on Frankie and mainly on Sammy and Dino, which
right.
is really interesting if people haven't heard it. But they talk about Frankie in this and Frank Sinatra and how he desperately wanted to go to be in this film. Now, the interesting connection on The Detective, of course, is that the character in it, oddly as this is the follow-up novel is what was then turned into Die Hard.
That's right. That's right.
And so, and obviously it was very different when they were going to make a sequel and have Sinatra in there. I think, did he appear in Towering Inferno? He appeared in lots of those kind of Jeopardy films. I think The Detective is just him at his kind of curmudgeonly, grumpy, but determined
yep.
best. And I think, I loved Sinatra. I think he gets, you know, when you see him in all of the, you know, the great kind of Hollywood blockbusters and musicals, I think he doesn't get the attention he does. There are certain people in film history who I think don't get the attention they deserve because they were so well known in other areas. And for me, Sinatra was definitely one of those. I mean, not at his level, but interesting enough, I've been watching a lot of films recently from that period. And my mind's gone blank on which they were now, with like Phil Silvers in there, who was just this kind of comedic guy who played Bilko on TV. Which is one of the very, I think Bilko is one of the greatest sitcoms ever made. And they did make a very bad remake of it with Steve Martin.
Yes, they did.
but Bilko, when you go and watch it, and him as just taking this character, and when you see him in movies, there's usually like the side, he usually plays the manager of someone famous like Danny Kaye or something. And you have these people who don't realize just how brilliant they were at what they did. And I love watching those folks on the films because you kind of go and look up who they are and their stories. And you know, so I always think about, I've got a signed picture of Phil Silvers somewhere in one of my boxes here.
Oh, wow.
I haven't put up yet.
Nice.
Yeah.
I really like The Detective, and like I said, it's the last kind of serious dramatic role he'd do for almost a decade. Around the same time, he did do two Tony Rome films, Tony Rome and Lady in Cement, where it's a little lighter, a little breezier, even it's still a detective story, but he's able to use his kind of loose charm to his advantage for a character. And then, you know, he did a couple more films and then didn't really do anything until the end of the 70s with a film called The First Deadly Sin that he did with Faye Dunaway, which was probably the other last time he kind of put it ever. Because he was famous for, you know, one or two takes and then you move on. So you had a certain type of director who could work with him.
And I think that's something, you know, we've obviously seen it now for a more sad reason with Bruce Willis, who's been doing these not terribly good video straight, the equivalent of what would have been straight to video, but now straight to streaming movies. And I think people were going, why is this happening? Why is this happening? I mean, it's Bruce Willis, and you know, I sometimes disagree with his politics, but he's Bruce Willis, and he's changed the way, one of the great kind of characters of the 80s and 90s and into the early 2000s with Fifth Element and stuff. And I was wondering what was going on. And then, of course, we heard that, you know, what he was doing really was filling up the coffers and people were paying him his million, 2 million, whatever it was.
Right.
Was on the thing and he turned up and said what he was, you know, asked to say, said thank you very much, put the money and then disappeared. And, you know, those films will not be things that, with one or two exceptions, things that, you know, he would have been desperately proud of, but he was doing what he needed to do. And I think, you know, Frank Sinatra was one of those as well. He would sometimes just go and go, I'll do this. You know, they're going to pay me to be Frank Sinatra and I'll go.
Correct.
And be, you know, as you said, that very loose kind of thing that he could do kind of almost without thinking because it was just him. And we have people, you know, we have people like that even now. What I like seeing is when you have people who then move out of that and then start coming back into it. One of the people who I've got, and I've always liked him, but I've always had growing respect, is I'm watching Hugh Grant now. Everything from Paddington 2, which I will put in my, I know people may laugh at it.
No.
Top five movies of the last 20 years.
It's
funny. It is moving. He is as good as he's been in anything he's ever been in. And if you watch that with anyone from 5 to 105, they will laugh, they will cry. And the end credits, anyone hasn't watched it, go and watch it. And they will have, and the end, the after credits bit where they have him performing a kind of Busby Berkeley style, whatever, is one of the most uplifting, cheerful, I mean, it's just brilliantly written. Brilliantly written. And but when you see him do that, and then you see him doing a very British Scandal where he's playing, which was obviously more of a limited series rather than a film, but then you see him doing the Florence Foster Jenkins, and then you see him doing, you know, The Gentleman, and then you see him, and I think he's just got to the point where he's obviously, it's more difficult for him to play, well, he can't play because he's too old, but the young leading man anyway.
Right.
But I think he's doing as good work, and this sounds crazy to some people, as any actor out there right now, and I just love watching him.
Well, and that's the thing of, you know, a career like this, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And so, you know, even Cary Grant eventually had to say, she has to chase me, I can't chase her. So, you know, and that's a nice problem to have. But yeah, exactly, to, you know, older, maybe a little heavier, a little more experience, and you're able to utilize those talents that you couldn't if you were doing a romantic comedy every other year.
No, absolutely. And I think there are a lot of those people. I'm seeing it, you know, now with Kevin Costner. You see it with a lot of those people who, you know, people used to fawn over in the 90s, probably went through a downslide as people tried to figure out who they were, and are now coming back just to do really good character performances. And you know, I think Kevin Costner is another one of those. If you go back and watch... my mind has gone blank of the film where he plays the spy, the Russian spy thing.
No Way Out.
No Way Out, that's it. And you go and watch that and you go, actually, you know what? This guy's really good. and I think we sometimes forget that about some of these people. You know, when you go and watch film, you go, God, you know. Matthew McConaughey's another one who's come out of the other side of that whole rom-com thing and is now just doing, you know, just really extraordinary work. So I love seeing, you know, and obviously you're seeing it on the female side with Sandra Bullock, and you're seeing
Correct.
It with just these incredible actors doing really special performances. So I mean, I think it's quite an interesting time. I also think we're getting some really good films right now. I will say that I thought Dune is like one of my favorite films of the last couple of years. I just thought it was fantastic, and that was something I never thought, particularly having forced myself to sit through, you know, David Lynch's version of Dune.
We all did.
With Sting in a diaper.
the conch shell underpants. That's that was.
I mean, nobody needs to spend time watching that again, and then you go and watch it, and you see these young actors, Zendaya, and you're seeing Timothée Chalamet and all of these people. They're just, I mean, it's incredible. And I think that film will become a benchmark for that kind of film in the future. I think it's beautifully done.
Yeah, I did enjoy Dune more than I thought I would. And, you know, the fact that now they are going to film a second, to which I first thought, well, why you couldn't even get the back. Well, either way, that's fine. But more than anything with this is, you know, film fans can now know, oh, this is what Lucas was reading when he was making his thing. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, look, there's the Space Christ Boy figure. So
everything that you kind of thought about. And I'm not the biggest Star Wars fan. I mean, I'll watch it. I think they're fun.
Yeah.
I've watched some of the limited seasons. Some of them are okay, and some of them, like Boba Fett, you're going, why waste the celluloid, but why waste the digital? It's almost like, I thought it was awful, quite frankly. I fell asleep through most of it.
What are your expectations on the Spinal Tap sequel?
Do you know, I knew it was happening, but I haven't read anything about it. So I don't know any of the details. So I'm coming to you now as the master of all tap knowledge. Although I remember I'm one of the few who went to see it in the cinema, I think.
Yes,
very early days.
Correct. I saw it on video. So it's interesting because, you know, Sky Point, the Mick Shrimpton, who just passed away recently.
Absolutely.
So, and I always tell me he also played drums on Mickey by Tony Basil. Nice. That's my thing that you could irritate people at parties for, as far as.
I love that.
Yeah. But, the three are back. So is Rob Reiner. The deal is Ian is dead, of course. Tony is no longer with us. And his wife finds a contract that the band owes them one more performance.
Oh, okay.
So there's that. And they're all, and the fact that they all agreed to be involved with it. So it's, I don't know. We will see. I don't think you can pick up where you left off.
No, but I think they'll come up as they probably did with, you know, when they're all sitting in the hotel room in Spinal Tap and they're listening to themselves on Where Are They Now?
Whatever. Right. Yes.
And they'll have them that, and they'll show them having solo careers of varying influence.
Correct.
You know, with Jazz Odyssey or what have you, coming together. They'll probably have them kind of meet the music where they all meet again after 30 years. And start kind of, do they get on anymore? We haven't talked for X number of years.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. I think as long as they bring in, and I know it wasn't totally, you know, part of that whole Christopher Guest kind of ensemble, but it had a lot of those people in there. I think if they have a lot of those Christopher Guest kind of alumni in there,
right,
who have been in everything like Mighty Wind and Best in Show and my favorite, Guffman.
Waiting for Guffman, yeah. So if, you know,
if they have those people in there,
right?
Then so, I think they can have some of those, those lyrics, and they can have some of those, that kind of lyrical style rather that they have there, in the improvisational style. Then I think it could be really, really funny. Let's hope it's not Anchorman 2 or Zoolander 2.
Yes. Fingers crossed. I'm scarily skeptical as of right now. But of course, it was just announced last week, so we'll see. We'll see what happens between now and when they actually do it.
Absolutely. So I think it's they're very talented people. I think it'll be really funny, and I think they're smart enough. I think in Zoolander 2, they were so aware of what Zoolander had become.
Right.
And it's still very watchable, that they kind of played towards it, whereas the joy of Zoolander, the joy of Anchorman, is they didn't play towards it. It was done really kind of straight.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the big problem with, you know, those sequels. And I think particularly people like, you know, the three main characters there, I think they're smart enough to be able to do something where, I'm not saying it will compare, because I think Spinal Tap to me is still one of the greatest things.
Yep.
I could watch it, and I think everyone would say this. I've watched it probably, maybe I've watched it 100 times, because it is one of those things, either if it's on TV or if I'm bored, I'll put it on, and it's just even in the background. And there are always lines in there that I haven't noticed before. I was watching it probably a month ago, and there's one of those where Duke Storm, I think it is, meets them in the lobby of the hotel, and the manager just turns around and said, "Oh, we'd love to stand and talk, but we have to go and sit in the lobby and wait for them."
Yep.
And it's just brilliant. You know, it's just a brilliant line, and you don't even kind of first time you watch it, and I'd never noticed that line before.
Yep.
And I was going, that's brilliant.
Yep, that the late Howard Hessman played that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now I ask, how many minutes has your wife ever completed the film? I know this is a wrinkle in the household.
I think she probably ends up putting in her headphones and watching something else. And I think it is just one of those films that I think you either get or you don't.
Right. Yep.
And like she'll watch. Yeah, Anchorman, we both will watch Zoolander. And it is, you know, there are moments in Zoolander that everyone knows where, you know, they're filling the gas tanks up with petrol and they're all doing weight before you go, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
That we all just sit there and we'll watch two or three times because it's just brilliant. Although, I will say, and I come from a different, whenever I want that kind of film, I still think that one of the kind of most fundamentally funny films I've ever seen is Dodgeball. And I just put that on, and it makes me laugh more than just about any film that I've seen, just because the whole setup is, you know, so with Rip Torn and with...
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball. So you know what? It's funny you mentioned that. I think of that... Of Rip Torn in that film is like the fish slapping dance. It's quick and it delivers, and that's all there is.
Absolutely. And it's, I love, you know, when he, well, I, you know, spoilers, but when, you know, he gets killed by the falling sign that's the leprechaun or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it's like he got killed by 2 tons of irony or whatever. I mean, it's just. I mean, and obviously some of it hasn't dated terribly well because you've got Lance Armstrong in it. And
yeah.
Of its time, I still watch it and think it. What's his name? Ben Stiller is perfect in that.
Yep, perfect foil on that. What's more brutal, those dodgeball matches or the rugby matches between the students and the staff in Monty Python and the Meaning of Life?
Those are brutal too. They are oddly enough, a lot of those kind of old British, well, that's not one of the old British films, but I've been watching some of the old British films where there's sporting occasions, and one of my favorite films I was just looking at recently, and it's actors who I've been thinking about for a while and just decided to go watch some of them. Richard Harris in This Sporting Life.
Yes. Yep.
Which is just, again, one of the great, we were, Britain in the, I mean, Britain still makes great films, but in the 50s, there was this whole period where you brought together these extraordinary playwrights and writers like Alan Sillitoe, who obviously put them together with this new generation as they were then, these incredible actors coming through, Richard Harris, Oliver Reed at his time, but like these things, people coming through in the 50s, and Tom Courtney.
Albert Finney, yeah.
Albert Finney. I mean, they're all coming out of RADA. They were the first, or maybe second generation coming out of a more working class background rather than kind of just coming out of RADA. And you saw these films and they are, you know, you go and watch Albert Finney and any of those. Oh gosh, what do you call them? The kitchen sink dramas. They're all being written by these, again, new playwrights coming through, and you found this combination. If people haven't watched those and they're really into looking at really, really terrific films and actors at the height of their powers, and Albert Finney and Alan Bates and all of those people.
Yep.
And I guess we're seeing maybe a little younger than them, but we're seeing some of the last of that generation still around. And if people haven't watched Succession, go and watch Brian Cox.
Yeah.
He was part of that. He was probably the last of that generation. He's what, in his late 70s, early 80s, maybe now?
Something like that. And full of stories. I mean, it's, you know, have him on. It's one of those, I know you're not supposed to do it these days on talk shows. You're supposed to go on and promote something. But like O'Toole and Kane and the others before them, you brought them on to tell stories. And I think Brian Cox is probably the last example of that, as you mentioned, for that generation.
Well, if you go and listen to, there's a talk show host from Britain who was the greatest of this. He's called Michael Parkinson. It's all online.
Yep, yep.
And he was the great one who would just bring on. I remember one where he had like it was something crazy, like you had David Niven and Muhammad Ali were on at the same time. And of course, it's totally different generations, but yet they ended up getting on really famously and ended up going out drinking or whatever because they were David Niven, but, who was one of my heroes. But
yes,
he would bring on, I remember once there was Peter Ustinov, and he was playing, he was talking, and Peter Ustinov was the greatest raconteur probably of all time, from the films anyway, and just hysterical if you go and watch him. And they brought him on, and then one in between, they brought Isaac Rabin on to play. It was Isaac Perlman, rather, to come on to play, the Godfather theme to violinist, play all kinds of amazing stuff. And then with him, Larry Adler to play harmonica. And you're just sitting there and thinking, you couldn't get this together now.
No.
I think the closest we kind of get to it, although they are promoting stuff, but at least he has fun with them. It's a very different kind of show. It's less reverential, but Graham Norton,
yeah, they do some silly stuff.
Well, because they just get people on to, and they get them. Quite frankly, they get them all drunk, and then they go, and then they start. And he's got, in that sense, no reverence for them as stars. He just wants them to tell stories.
Correct.
And people, you know, I know people who've have been to the show and they just go, you know, it, the people want to be on that show, and in the 70s and early 80s and, well, late 60s through to the early 80s, everyone wanted to be on the Parkinson show. And if you go and watch that, go on YouTube, you'll see Michael Parkinson. And it is everyone. He would have Fred Astaire, or sometimes if it was someone particularly, you know, huge, they'd just be one guest. But usually he'd go, well, here's Fred Astaire and let me bring on blah, 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 who's someone totally different. And they would sit there and have a conversation, like a proper conversation, in the way that, I guess, was it maybe in the U.S., was it Dick Cavett would do it, or I'm trying to think who it would be.
Well, but before he got canceled, Charlie Rose was another one-on-one that took for like an hour.
Yeah. And so you can have those kind of genuine conversations about, you know, their life. I mean, these people had incredible lives. You think of a lot of the people who were talking in the 70s had probably been, some of them had either been soldiers in the World War, or some of the women had been, you know, doing, you know, support work in the World War, had been doing spy, you know, Julia Child talking about being the OCC and all of that. And they would allow them to talk about this. It's kind of, in a way, that's how I, not that I'm saying I'm as good as those, but when I talk to people like Jacques Pepin, I go, why would anyone listen to a Jacques Pepin interview and want me to talk? If that makes sense.
Yep.
And
yeah.
That's what I think Michael Parkinson was like.
Well, I'm going to wrap things up in a moment, Simon. I really, really appreciate your time on this. But I want to start, the first setup question is, what is your view on Kenneth Branagh's take on Hercule Poirot?
I thought the first one of the two was the better.
Mm-hmm. Yep, agreed.
I thought Death on the Nile was perfectly serviceable in terms of filmmaking. But we know that he's capable of much more. I thought Belfast was much better and is a really, really amazing film.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. It's what I call a Sunday afternoon film. You have lunch on a Sunday, you have a glass of wine, you plop in front of the television, you want to watch something, you know, just as you might have done back in the old days with Albert Finney, now you'll do it with Kenneth Branagh. And I think it's really good. I think it's shown in not to its best, because we're now developing those kind of things with Knives Out, which I really loved. And I just think we're seeing what can be done in that kind of old school kind of whodunit thing. And I think Knives Out showed it up a bit. But I still think the very first one was fantastic.
Okay, I'm with you on that. So I want you to back me up on this one, because both of them have the kind of James Bond action hero beginnings that have nothing to do with the original plot, you know, with the plot of itself, and then the ends. If Sir Ken's going to do that, then I want Helen Mirren in a sexy Miss Marple reboot.
With
a Ferrari. You know, she can still prune. She can still do the gardening and do the things, but you know, she's dressed like she is in red. And if you're gonna go down that path with the characters from Agatha Christie, you know, so somebody's has to get this going. Who do we talk to?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, you know, Miss Marple is one of my, you know, my favorites. And I, much as I liked Angela Lansbury, who was very good as Miss Marple, the best was, oh my gosh, the lady who was in Blythe Spirit.
Yes, and, I know. As soon as you mentioned it, yep.
And my mind complete. She was one of the greats. And of course, now my mind has completely Margaret something, and my mind has completely
not
gone.
Rutherford.
Margaret Rutherford.
Oh wow! Okay, I did nail. Look at that! I got it. I was thinking, Geraldine McEwen, but no, you're right, Margaret Rutherford.
Margaret Rutherford. And so, if you haven't seen any of those, like her Blythe Spirit and her Miss Marples, where she plays the kind of what looks like the slightly doddery old grandma, but actually ends up being kind of, you know, Miss Marple, basically. Those are wonderful, and I think she would be absolutely perfect. I think Helena would be absolutely perfect in those. But there's a few people in the kind of British kind of. If you haven't seen, I think it's called Tea with the Danes.
Yes,
and it's all of these amazing Danes of the British Empire, like Laurence Olivier's, you know, wife Jean. Oh, my mind.
Joan Plowright.
And then all of these incredible things, Maggie Smith, and apparently they meet up once a month.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
One of their houses. And can you imagine, they all, like, there's five of them or something, and they all meet up, and they're all Danes of the British Empire. They're all amazing actors, of course. And they all just get there, and they basically share stories, which you can imagine what some of those stories would be.
Exactly.
And it's on Hulu, if you haven't seen it.
I own a copy of it, and yeah, it's a lot of fun. You would think that could be a podcast with Joan and Maggie and Eileen Atkins, and yeah, so.
I mean, it's to me, that's just like, let's go to have some fun with, you know, and listening to great actors telling thespian stories, I think is one of the great kind of things we should keep and record, because, you know, if you go and listen to, you know, Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen, or you go and listen to any of these folks, these are stories that we won't get again, because I don't know that people come out of that theatrical tradition as these people did, and so they don't have those stories of traveling around the United States or traveling around Britain in little theater companies where basically they're all living in these bed fits and they're all, you know, having to spend no money at all so they can go and perform, you know, the Bard or whatever, Shakespeare play they're going to be doing. And to me, it's just complete joy when you hear them talking.
So they just need an endorsement from a tea company and or a distillery, and they can get that going, I think.
Oh, yeah, that would be really fantastic.
All right, before we go, I guess I forgot to ask this. Are you going to be a part of the Iron Chef reboot in any way?
No, I'm not. I'm not. And I wish, trust me, I mean, all the folks I know are in there. Just because of what I was filming and what they're filming, I couldn't do it. But, you know, who knows what the future holds.
There you go. Okay.
Iron Chef to me is, you know, has a very special part in my heart because it was the first, or next Iron Chef was the very first show I ever did. And the fact that it wouldn't have been Iron Chef without Alton or without Mark Dacascos.
Correct.
So I'm thrilled to know that two of my very good pals are in there.
Okay, well, fingers crossed. Yes, I'm excited for the reboot, so they have to bring you back. So, but that's just, you know, there you go. So fingers crossed there. Simon, where can people go to find Eat My Globe and all things Simon?
So if you go to any of your, you know, your prod, I haven't even had a gin and tonic yet. If you go to any of your podcast providers, you know, Apple or any of the ones you use, you'll find me on there under Eat My Globe. Obviously, you can go to eatmyglobe.com and that will have every episode and you can subscribe. If you go to my podcast, simonmajumdar.com, we'll have a link to it on there. We also go and sign up for our newsletter that we send out every month, which will talk about the new episodes, has recipes that we send out every month and all of that. The other thing, and then we have a Patreon account, patreon.com/eatmyglobe, which helps support us because we do, you know, buying materials and stuff could get quite expensive. And then we love hearing back from people. So if people do listen and like it, it's always good, as I'm sure you know with your show, if you get good reviews and everything, then that just makes things a lot easier for everybody.
Right. Well, and you mentioned Progcast. At least it wasn't a Progcast, because that's a lot of discussion of yes.
Yes, that's a lot.
All right, Simon, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you, and good luck with the rest of the season. And I know we'll be chatting fairly soon for season 9.
Well, I'm already working on it now. Good luck with everything you do. I love the fact that you're out there supporting the movies, and also what I like is you're not just supporting new movies. You know, I love that I can come on and have a discussion with you about movies that people may have forgotten or don't know about but really should. And I think that's just, yeah, we need to really keep these films in there because we've got a whole family of films. And as you know, I'm a bit of a film fanatic.
Well, and, if you get a chance, if you want, because I try to ask every week on Tuesdays or Wednesdays or Thursdays on what we call it the grab a pencil portion of the show, which I started because of the pandemic. So, and now I have people who keep notebooks right by their telly and or people who just post and say, I'm sorry, I didn't see anything this week. And I'm like, it's fine. But anyway, you know, feel free to submit a list anytime and we'll include it on the show.
Fantastic. I will do that. I shall get my little notebook out.
All right. Thanks, Simon.
My very great pleasure. Talk to you soon.
You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Thanks again to Simon for being one of the usual suspects here on this program. I always appreciate it. Got a lot of territory to cover. I want to start with the fact that last week's show was already done before the death of actor Fred Ward. And Fred was one of those guys, of course, maybe I'm of a certain age, that his first film credit, or TV miniseries credit, I guess, 1973, and appeared in films like Ginger in the Morning in 1974, Tilt in 1979. He'd done a couple of TV credits and a couple of movies, but so I got to see him early on in his career. Of course, he was one of the prisoners in the Clint Eastwood film Escape from Alcatraz, directed by Don Siegel, and then had roles in Carney, Southern Comfort, Time Rider, The Right Stuff, of course, is Gus Grissom, Silkwood, Uncommon Valor, Swing Shift, Secret Admirer, Remo Williams, which I just watched. It just came out on Blu-ray, a couple months ago? And I know they wanted it to make a series of a blue-collar James Bond. And while I thought the film was okay, he was really good in it. He did exactly what he had to do. And just going through, of course, Tremors, he's always going to be a favorite in the cult film world because of Tremors. So there's always that. Henry in June, the first NC-17 film. Miami Blues, which needs more audiences checking that film out. Of course, it's him griping as Walter Stuckel in The Player about there's too much editing in films. You need single long takes. Like Orson Welles' Touch of Evil or Robert Altman's Beginning to the Player. Bob Roberts, Shortcuts, Naked Gun 33 and a Third. The man worked on anything and everything whenever possible. His last credit that I saw was Two Guns back in 2013. So salute to Fred Ward, who passed away on May 8th at the age of 79. I am hoping to get Brian Hartz on to talk about the death of Vangelis, so I'm going to wait on going through his, reading the credits off of IMDb for the program this week. So hopefully going to go into a little bit. But we will end the show with some Vangelis at the end. That's usually where it goes. But I want to catch up on a few titles I got to watch and then to let you know what's coming on around town. And then we'll grab a pencil. There's a really good documentary now out on video on demand called Building a Bridge. And Martin Scorsese is an executive producer on this. And if you know Scorsese, a very, very devout a very famous Catholic, I should say. And this is about James Martin, a Jesuit who has become one of the Talking Heads, one of the supporters of Catholics in the LGBTQ community. And we see his kind of rise to this position. It didn't, it just wound up becoming that way, and him going to conference, having the ear of Pope Francis for a while. We see him working in his garden in New York. We also see a church militant from Ferndale, Michigan, of all places, that has become the antagonist for Martin. But he talks about having, James Martin does, about having an understanding and a love and love thy neighbor. And so we get to see him about his daily business, going to a conference in Dublin. And so and there's moments, as I mentioned, with the I mentioned that there is a kind of an antagonist in this film, church militant who wants to save souls. Name is Michael Forrest. Quite a character if you see him. And about two-thirds of the way through the film, you wonder if there's going to be an encounter between these two heads of talking. There isn't. Not really a spoiler alert. But I think that we are used to having a confrontational relationship. Like Roger and me, there is no meeting of the two at the end. But we do get an opposing voice in this documentary, so it doesn't feel like a complete commercial for James Martin, which I understand. And, of course, this guy, Michael Forrest, is living in Ferndale, which is one of the better gay-friendly communities in the Detroit area, in that portion of Michigan. But seeing Martin do his work, helping out people, especially after the Pulse shooting, it's a good look at this man doing some really hard work. So anyway, look for Building a Bridge. It's out on video on demand. Also on video from the Coen Film Collection is a 1953 experimental horror film called Dementia. It is mostly a silent film. We get a very long quote that kind of is poking the finger. Our chest is getting poked at by the verbal finger of Preston Sturges talking about how important this film is, which... Not the greatest move, but Adrian Barrett plays a woman who is having dreams of having these dreams that might be altering her reality, and how she becomes a switchblade walking vigilante. It is mostly a silent picture. It is only the score, which at times pushes its limits, even for a film that clocks in at under an hour. It's about 53 minutes. Really good black and white photography by William Thompson. And why do I know the name William Thompson? Because William Thompson was the director of photography on Ed Wood's Plan 9 from Outer Space. And there is a scene in a graveyard. It's better than Plan 9, but there's a couple moments, a couple tombstones where one starts to snicker at this. But we get to see this woman have some problems between fantasy and reality. Police officer chasing her, and it's played by the same actor who plays her father, and we get those flashbacks. Anyway, but I think for 1953 audiences, they didn't quite know what to think of this. This was not a scary movie. I mean, this is not the traditional scary B movie or killer lurking movie. It's more if it's, is it all in her head? Is she live or is this Memorex? And we get a nice hook of an ending of, is this the end? So for that part, it's pretty bold for, like I said, 1953 standards. This is the type of experimental filmmaking that we would make fun of even more in the 1960s, or as Abdullah would say, baby clown smoking a cigarette playing chess with death. The film was then re-edited with voiceover and re-released as Daughter of Horror, which basically tells you what's going on. And it's just, it's that thing where you are spoon-fed the feelings of the film by this voiceover artist. There is a moment where we think there's time for the lead to rest, and the voice lets us know that she is safe in the hallucinated world of your mind. Not the best cutting of that. And of course, you're selling the same dish twice. But for low budget avant-garde filmmaking in 1953, it's a curiosity. It's worth checking out, and it's short. So look for Dementia on Coen Film Collection on Blu-ray. Also out on IndiePix, another curiosity. These are far more interesting for me than the giant multiplex blockbusters that are plaguing the cinemas right now. This is a Uruguayan film called Straight to VHS, and it is a look into a film that in Uruguay has received cult status for its that kind of fun bad, or it's so bad it's good. And of course, you know, that's the home base here for film sociology. There was in 1988 a film called Act of Violence in a Young Journalist, and it's a mixture of docudrama, romance, and stalker thriller about a young female reporter who is interviewing people, real life people, about violence in their country. And the film itself is wedged and kind of shifts awkwardly from docudrama to romance to stalker thriller. Very low budget, and this film had a few releases on home video. It was like the first big home video sensation with a small group, thus the cult status. I think there's like 100 copies that were at one point found. And this, the filmmaker, Emilio Silva Torres, is trying to find out something, anything about the phenomena. It's almost like, did this film even exist? And so we get to see his travels along the way. The film's under 80 minutes, and even though it starts to slow down in the first two thirds, but hearing other filmmakers from Uruguay and surrounding countries talk about its impact and how one person will say it's really shoddy editing, and another filmmaker will say, well, this is just like what Godard did. It's one of that kind of ride the line. It's like there have been times where I've had film arguments with my buddy Chris Lloyd of the Film Yap, and he will say he hates a particular film because it's like this, and it's the exact same reason why I like the film. So those kinds of mature cinematic arguments. So anyway, we find the filmmaker trying to find out more about the filmmaker of Act of Violence in a Young Journalist. There's a couple of possible setups with actors who are in the film, and then they disappear mysteriously, or they just stop talking about it. So there's a little mystique to it. The last third of the film kind of blurs reality and fantasy a little too much for my taste, but it's still a curiosity. We find out Manuel Lamas, who made the film, made one other film and died in 2004. But the searching for it, wanting to find out more, that I could really relate to that. And you know, it's kind of like what people do now as far as trying to peek behind the curtain of Tommy Wiseau, or the gentleman who made Miami Connection, or the gentleman who made Birdemic. So then apparently, you know, people were saying this was The Room or the Birdemic of Uruguay. So Straight to VHS was fun, and it's out on a video from IndiePix. It also comes with the film Act of Violence in a Young Journalist. And it's not as fun as The Room or Birdemic or Miami Connection, but I can see why it got the attention it did from a handful of filmmakers and why they want to seek it out. It is, you know, choppily made, choppily edited. The acting's a little much. We do get the actor playing the journalist report interviewing real people on the street, and then we get there's a lot of food talk. There is a sex scene that goes on a little too long, not as long as Tommy Wiseau's sex scenes in The Room. We get bad chases, we get bad attacks, we get a lot, you know, the killer and one of his victims locked in a house for a climax that's silly at best. And as I wrote in my notes, a nude sunbathing ending. So, the double feature of Straight to VHS and an act of violence and a Young Journalist is available on IndiePix. Have some pizza and beers and check those out. I also revisited a film. I remember not liking it, and I revisited it again and wound up liking it. Now, it could be that I'm older, it could be time, could be the timing of the first time I saw the film or the second time I saw the film. But the 2006 film, A Good Year, with Russell Crowe, directed by Ridley Scott, the non-Gladiator movie, the non-action film from Russell Crowe collaborating with Ridley Scott, where he plays a banker, not the nicest banker in the world, who winds up inheriting his uncle's vineyard in France, his uncle played by Albert Finney. Freddie Highmore plays Russell Crowe in flashbacks. I always forget Tom Hollander was in this. This might have been one of my early Tom Hollander encounters. And it's basically A Year in Provence with Russell Crowe. And, and this was the film that introduced me to Marion Cotillard. So this got that going for it. And I remember the first time seeing this, I didn't think Crowe could do comedy. And he's fine. He's, you know, it's a change of pace from the other stuff that he'd been doing. And doesn't take himself too seriously. I think I remember saying this to my wife that the first time I watched it, I thought he was trying too hard. And my wife asked, what does that mean? So, you know, aging and lightening up will do that at times. But, yeah, and it's gorgeous shot, you know, gorgeously shot in the south of France. And who wouldn't want to spend a year in Provence, even if the wine in this particular vineyard is not good. But yeah, it was fun to revisit a good year. Not Goodyear, that's a tire, but that's out on video. Okay, just a reminder that over at Landmark, you have Everything Everywhere All at Once and The Duke, that's still playing. Over at the Can-Can this weekend, Vortex, Everywhere, Everything Everywhere All at Once, Emergency, Princess Mononoke on the 21st. Josie and the Pussycats with Vanity Rex on the 22nd, Wine and Canvas on the 22nd, Hustlers on the 23rd, The Conductor on the 23rd, Black in America, the Heritage Series with All Deliberate Speed on the 28th. All of that is happening over at the Can-Can at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. Depending on when you're listening to this, Friday and Saturday, May 20th and 21st, 2 and 7:30 p.m., and kudos for them to get the 1957 Western 310 to Yuma. Remember the remake, Russell Crowe, Christian Bale, it all comes around. But yeah, Van Heflin, Glenn Ford, Felicia Farr, that's going to be fun to watch on the big screen in Franklin. Friday and Saturday, May 27th and 28th at 2 and 7:30 p.m. Clue. And again, I don't know which ending they have. You'll have to find out. June 3rd and 4th, 2 and 7:30 p.m. Big Trouble in Little China is happening over there. And then June 7th, Tuesday, 10 a.m., the first Scooby-Doo, for those who are into that. That is happening at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. Over at the Tibbs Drive-In, it's good to have the drive-ins back. So just on screen one, Doctor Strange and Everything Everywhere All at Once. Now there's a visual double feature right there. On screen two is Men and Emergency. Screen three, Firestarter and Ambulance. And on screen four, The Bad Guys and Sonic the Hedgehog 2. Happening over at the Tibbs. Over at the Skyline, we have Doctor Strange and Fantastic Beasts, The Secret of Dumbledore. Thursday, May 26th, will be Top Gun Maverick, plus two other movies on Friday the 27th. Monday, June 6th, is Back to the Drive-In documentary, celebrating National Drive-In Day. And mark your calendars, Friday, August 26th, Super Monster Movie Fest, Size Matters. That's happening August 26th and 27th. At the Skyline Theater in Shelbyville. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. All right, friends, grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching this week. We start on Twitter with Richard Probst. Hello, Richard. Sir Paul Hums. Chippendale, Rescue Rangers, Firestarter, and No Vacancy. At the Indiana Pizza Club writes Red Rocket and Walking and Talking from 1996. Millennia writes Breakfast Club. It's been over 10 years since I'd seen it. Things are the same as they ever were. Okay. I wondered if as you got older, one's attitudes change about the characters in John Hughes films. We'll just have to see. And I do want to mention a couple of podcasts involving my buddy Taffeta V. We've she's been a guest on the show, and I've mentioned Golan Globus. It's fun hearing her on Golan Globus. There are a couple of podcasts she works on. One is Centerfold, Revealing Culture Through Playboy, and it's her and another guest who basically go through old issues of Playboy magazine. So, you know, take that. And there are film reviews in there, I know. You can also hear Bedtime, it's called Late with Taffy DeVee, Bedtime Stories and Lullabies for People Who Never Sleep. So imagine, if you will, as I've described this on Twitter, as one of those fast-talking dames from the 40s mixed in with one of those older cinematic broads who could beat you up from the 60s, and Lynn Thigpen from the Warriors. Late with Taffy DeVee. Bedtime Stories and Lullabies for People Who Never Sleep. That's happening on Twitter. Go look at her. She's at Taffy DeVee. You can get all the information over there. And, of course, my buddies over at Golan Globus. Always fun to hear from them. And speaking of Golan Globus Theater, which I find them on Twitter. You should check out their page. Their new episode, the film Shoot Fighter. So if you're – I'll put it this way. If you're a fan of The Karate Kid or – Cobra Kai. This is in that. It's an off branch of that family tree, but you should check it out anyway. So, those are from the guys over at Golan Globus Theater. Okay, we go back to Facebook. Now I have to remind folks. Sometimes people post about this week's question on last week's post, and of course last week we talked about if you were ever turned away as a young person from seeing an R-rated movie. So we have a few more answers on this because of last week's page. But so going back, Tom writes, both versions of Murder on the Orient Express. My buddy Bill Simmons writes, I'm now reading the full post, Matthew, and my answer is no, I've never was turned away, probably because I had a white streak in my hair at age 13. I'm sure you did, Bill. That explains a lot. I got my first gray hair at 20, not nearly as dashing as yours. Gary writes, I was able to walk in and see Porky's as a 16-year-old. A week later, I tried to get a date to see it because I'm all class and was not allowed due to age. I said, I just saw it last week by myself at this very theater. And the guy asked, did you like it? And he writes in all caps, obviously. Jennifer writes, yes, I don't recall exactly what movie, but I think it was one of the Halloween or Friday the 13th early 80s sequels. That happens. Kara writes, nope, saw Purple Rain at 15, and a couple of 11-year-old boys ask if I pretend to be their mom. Wow, you could be Angela Lansbury. Or, I can't remember her name, but the actress who played Cary Grant's mother in North by Northwest, who was younger than Cary Grant. Pam writes, I believe we were when we went to see Slaughter High. Moving on. Kathleen writes, I wasn't turned away, but my mother ran in and grabbed me out of the theater for the showing of Cleopatra. No, Kathleen, she pulled you out because that's a four-hour soap opera, and nobody has any business watching that. David writes, I remember buying a ticket for Battlefield Earth so I could sneak in the Starship Troopers. James writes, I was usually too chicken back then, but I was allowed to see Kentucky Fried Movie when I was 16. No questions asked. Ray writes, hi, Ray Steele. And by the way, if you go on Channel 6, you can see some video footage of Ray Steele and I discussing movies set in the Indianapolis 500. He writes, I never tried, didn't have to, because we got HBO when I was 9. We had cable at an early age as well, Ray, so thank you for that. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Okay, back to the list. Missy writes, Spider-Man No Way Home and the new version of Firestarter. Andrew writes, Oceans 11, 12, and 13. Tony writes, Mr. Turner, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Train to Busan, and Arrival. Hopefully those weren't in a row, Tony. Taylor writes, Dune, Casablanca, Red, 200 Motels, and Spider-Man No Way Home. Mary writes, The Invasion of the Killer Donuts. Lou Harry writes, Love in the Afternoon. Amanda writes, About Time, and deemed it just lovely. Jessica writes, The Deep House and The Bubble. Nancy writes, The Duke. Abby writes, The Documentary Our Father. Of course, that has the Indianapolis connection. Cassie writes, Doctor Strange. Molly writes, the unbearable weight of massive talent. Tiffany writes, Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. Yeah. Dustin writes, Lassie Come Home, For Colored Girls, the 2013 TV movie Remember Sunday, and Doctor Strange. Lucinda writes, Blinded by the Light, Doctor Strange, Gunpowder, and Milkshake. Amanda writes, Death the Smoochie. Abdul writes, Doctor Strange. David writes, My Man Godfrey. Andra Faye, you uppity blues woman and frequent moviegoer. Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, and Dirty Harry. I'm going to lie and say, Andra Faye, that's a double feature you watched. Sean writes, Doctor Strange. Dee Dee writes, Money Talks and No Time to Die. Hi, Dee Dee Servino, Drinks with Dee Dee. Paul is in Money Talks, just so you know. Nikki writes, Fences. Can't believe I had never heard of it and just stumbled upon it. Phenomenal acting, but so sad. Yes, that is correct, Nikki. And kudos for Mr. Washington for starring and directing in that particular production. Nikki writes, The Northman. Amy writes, Our Father, an exciting short film coming to film festivals all over the world called Mare Upon Sons by my incredibly talented filmmaker pal, Sam Mipurian. Got to get Sam on your show. Thank you, Amy. Well, you know where to find me. Jamie writes, Live Action Mulan, Lost City, and Wonder Woman Bloodlines. Alice writes, We finished The Last Jedi and started in on The Mandalorian. We've already seen Mandalorian, but this is the kid's first time through. I get it. That happens. I've been trying to catch up on Ted Lasso with my family. Joe writes, Superstar and Home Fries. I've been listening to Molly Shannon's autobiography and have a new appreciation for Mary, yeah, for the MKG character. I get it. Jesse writes, Blue Angel, The Daughters of the Dragon, The Gang's All Here, Night of the Hunter, Do the Right Thing, and Easy Money. Eric writes, Operation Mincemeat, The Flight of the Phoenix, and Zero Hour, which was the principal inspiration for Airplane. That's true. And isn't half bad, but of course isn't nearly as funny. Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit smoking, says Sterling Hayden. Yeah, there's been a couple of people that have just discovered Zero Hour, so I'm glad that's the gift that keeps on giving. Mike writes, Bad Guys. Al writes, I didn't see a movie, but I did see a production of the complete works of William Shakespeare Abridged. It was pretty funny. Would recommend. Thank you, sir. Megan writes, While You Were Sleeping, Tootsie, and Unforgivable. Jeff writes, The 90s Batman movies. Okay. Jed writes, Just watched Background to Danger, a World War II suspense drama. George Raff, Sidney Greenstreet, and Peter Lorre. Really enjoyed it. Highly recommend for any classic film fan. I love Jed dipping into old titles, man. He's consistent on that. Daniel writes, I confess, Topaz, and the most recent West Side Story. Andrea writes, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Rachel writes, Selena, I Was on a Plane. Not Selena on a Plane, that's a different movie. JJ writes, The Player, Old, Doctor Strange, Presumed Innocent, and The Fugitive. Carrie writes, Fantastic Mr. Fox, and Chaos Walking. Joe writes, Fistful of Dollars. Devin writes, Spring Awakening. Thomas writes, Downton Abbey, and Operation Mincemeat. Sarah writes, Sonic 2. Phil writes, Moon, 2009 film starring Sam Rockwell. Very good. Vince writes, I watched Killer Joe, and I wish I hadn't. You're not the first to say that, Joe. Vince, I understand. I own a copy of it on DVD. Oh, and have some chicken wings while you. Connor writes, Highlander and Free Guy. Liz writes, just watched Senior Year on Netflix. Literally took me most of the show till I realized it was a spoof. I know somebody who didn't know it was a bit at a Spinal Tap concert, so it's okay. Beverly writes, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. David writes, Constantine. Aaron writes, Dear Evan Hansen. Christopher Lloyd, film, yep. This week it's Lilies in the Field for his Reeling Back. And you might hear some stuff written by me. You might see some stuff written by me soon. Men, Night Sky, and Pleasure. Darlene writes, All Good Things. Joan writes, Joan Heimbrook. I watched Steel Magnolias for the 100th time because Steve and Allie took me to see the play at IRT on Sunday. A Tearful Sunday to prep me from being gutted last night in the second to last episode of This Is Us. I think I might need an emotional cutter. I'm with you, Joan. There was, when my mother died when I was in college, there were three films that she loved to watch and she could watch all the time, and I couldn't watch them for years. And Steel Magnolias was one of them, Driving Miss Daisy, and Terms of Endearment. So hopefully you found an emotional, you know, Top Chef. You could probably watch Top Chef. That would be an emotional cutter after watching Steel Magnolias. Doug writes the most recent Death on the Nile, The Skin Game, and Vertigo, the latter of which we're studying right now. Also, the PBS airing of Sutton Foster in Anything Goes. Kurt writes, I watched Uncle P this morning, starring Master P. Thank you, Kurt. Keith writes, Baby Driver, Firestarter, the original Firestarter, House Sitter, 13 Going on 30, Back to the Future, Back to the Future 3, apparently we just forget too, Independence Day, Pocketful of Miracles, So Big, The Barefoot Contessa, not that Barefoot Contessa, Crossing Delancey, I need to revisit Crossing Delancey, thanks Keith, and A Farewell to Arms. Magnus writes, Firestarter and Monstrous, both nothing special. Thank you, sir. Welcome aboard. Chris writes The Queen. Molly writes Ghostbusters Afterlife. Robert Muggy writes How Green Was My Valley, The Dead, Hold Back the Dawn, The Big Knife, and repeat viewing of Written on the Wind. Thank you, Robert. JD writes, finally saw Knives Out. Ron writes, Dune. It's taken me this long to finally see this because that's how long the bad taste from Lynch has stayed in my mouth. Wow. Well, better late than never, Ron. And yes, it is better than David Lynch's version. Cassandra writes, we watched Up and part of Top Gun. Other than that, we finished the second season of Bridgerton. Jackie writes, Stone Pillow. Nick Rogers writes, Firestarter, On the Count of Three, The Innocents, Dog, We're All Going to the World's Fair, and After Yang. Lila writes, Grease and Everything Everywhere All at Once. Eden writes, Our Father. Gary writes, Moonwolf, The Guillotines, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, Revenge of the Sith, Zombies Under the Bed, Slink, Awakened, Saturday, Morning Mystery, Inbred, Occupant, Jugface, Evil Inside, Seven Below, In the Dark, and Return to Horror High. Thank you, Gary. Way to dig deep there. Adrian writes Old Henry. Britt writes Senior Year and The Fugitive. Jesse writes, fun to see everyone's responses all across the board. Thank you. Yes, Jesse, this is why I'm still doing this after 2 years. This is fun. I'm glad you're getting, and hopefully you're getting some titles and some inspiration. Anthony writes, Barefoot in the Park, The Thing, and Riding the Bullet. Moveen writes, White on Snow, The Last Valley, and Dog. Oh, White as Snow, white, not White on Snow. Yeah, I do remember The Last Valley. That's Michael Caine and Omar Sharif about the 30-Year War. And yes, The Dog film with Channing Tatum. James writes, The Spider-Woman Strikes Back, Curse of the Undead, Secret of the Blue Room, and The Mystery of Edwin Drood. Karen writes, Petite Maman, strange but interesting. I did like Petite Maman, Karen. And Moonstruck, In Honor of the Full Moon, one of my favorites. Linda writes, The New Cyrano and Belfast. David writes, going to see Rock and Roll High School at Bloomington's Cicada Cinema. Very cool. And finally, Tom writes, that old fear-mongering classic, The Late Great Planet Earth, predicting every malady but global warning, 70s panic porn. Yeah, Tom, I remember those. Oh gosh, there's a slew of old episodes of Sneak Previews and Siskel and Ebert that are now available on YouTube. And it's been fun revisiting those because some of them I remember the original broadcast. That explains a lot. But quite often in their Dogs of the Week would be the studio that put out those films, In Search of Noah's Ark and Hangar 18 and all that nonsense. So thank you, Tom. Way to drive that in there. And there you go, friends. That's what you've been watching. So hopefully you've been able to find some titles, some good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. And thanks for listening. We're going to end this week's show with a little bit of an audio tribute to Vangelis. We're going to talk more about his work on next week's program, but a great excuse to play from 1982's Blade Runner, Blade Runner Blues. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!